dark. Book 4. What happened in Lacedaemon? So now they were in the deep valley of Lacedaemon, and drove up to the gate of the illustrious King Menelaus. They found him holding a feast with a large company of friends, for his daughter and for his admirable son at the same time in his own house. He was giving his daughter to the son of Achilles the Invincible. He had promised to give her first in Troy, and now the gods were bringing off the match. He was sending her with horses and chariots to the far-famed city of the Myrmidons, where the young man was king. He was bringing from Sparta the daughter of Alector for his son, a fine young man called Megapenthes, the son of sorrow, late born and the son of a slave woman, for the gods had given Helen no more children after her first daughter Hermione, a girl as lovely as golden Aphrodite. And so there was feasting in the lofty hall, all the neighbors and friends of Menelaus enjoying themselves mightily. In the company was a minstrel playing divinely upon the harp, and as he struck up his tune, a couple of tumblers were making wheels all over the place. The two young men stopped their horses before the gateway of the mansion, and out came my lord Eteoneus, one of the king's men-in-waiting. When he saw them, he went into the house to tell the news to the king, and as he reached them, he said in plain words, "Here are two strangers, your majesty. They look like young princes. Tell me if we are to put up their horses or send them to find entertainment elsewhere." This made Menelaus very angry, and he said, "I didn't know before that you were a fool, Eteoneus Boethiades, but what you say now is a child's foolish prattle. How often have we eaten the food of a stranger, you and I, in other parts of the world, on our long journey home, praying that Zeus might somewhere give us rest and peace at last? Go and take out their horses and bring the men in to share our feast." The man shot out of the hall and called the others to lend him a hand. They took the horses from under the yoke, all in a sweat, and tied them up at the stalls, and gave them a feed of spelt mixed with white barley. Then they tilted the car against the inner wall of the doorway, and led the men into the stately hall. How astonished the strangers were at what they saw round them in this royal house! For a brilliance like the light of sun or moon filled the lofty rooms. When they had gazed in delight at everything, the servants took charge of them and led them to the bathroom, bathed them and rubbed them with oil, dressed them in woolen robes and tunics, and conducted them to seats beside Menelaus. A maid poured the hand wash out of a golden jug over a silver basin and set a smooth table by their side. A dignified housewife brought them bread and laid ready all sorts of victuals, for she did not spare her store. A carver set out plates of all sorts of meat and put golden cups ready at hand. There stood their host with his golden brown hair piled in a glossy mass upon his head and falling in a thick bush over his shoulders. He received them with the words, "Break your bread and be welcome. After you have dined, you shall tell us who you are, for you do your parents credit. You must come of a line of princes ruling by divine right, since no bad stock would produce men like you." As he said this, he set before them a good juicy chuck from the roast sirloin with his own hands, the portion of honor which had been set before himself, and they helped themselves to the good things that lay ready. Then, after they had taken all they wanted to eat and drink, Telemachus moved his head close to Nestor's son, that the others might not hear, and said, "Just look, Nestoridas, dear old boy, look at the bronze gleaming all over these resounding halls, the gold, the amber, the silver, the ivory. I think Zeus must have a palace like this in Olympus when I see all these treasures that no tongue could tell. I am fairly amazed." Menelaus overheard this and said, "My dear boys, no one can be compared with Zeus. Let me tell you, his halls are imperishable, and so are his treasures. But there may be a man to match me, or there may not. I offer no opinion." "Ah, yes, I have suffered much and wandered far while I collected my treasures in my ships and came home after 7 long years. I went to Cyprus, Phoenicia, Egypt. I saw the Ethiopians, the Sidonians, the Arembans. I went to Libya, where the lambs are born with horns, ready-made. Yes, the ewes wean their lambs 3 times every blessed year. There neither prince nor shepherd lacks cheese or meat or fresh milk. The ewes always have milk in their dugs all the year round. And while I was in those parts and collecting all this wealth, a man was murdering my brother, who looked for anything but that, by the machinations of his accursed wife. So, you see, not for nothing I got my royal state. You will have heard all this from your fathers, whoever they may be, since I had very much to suffer, and left a fine domain to be ruined. Well laid out indeed it was, and full of excellent stuff. I wish I had kept only 1/3 of it and stayed at home and saved all those lives which were lost on the wide plains of Troy, far from Argos and the fine horses that Argos breeds. But, however, although I mourn for them all and often sit brooding in my mansion, sometimes I weep outright and so ease my heart a bit. Sometimes again I stop. A man soon has enough of groans, which fairly frees him to the bones. However, I do not mourn so much for the whole lot of them, though I really am sorry for them, as for one man who keeps me awake at night and will not let me eat because I miss him so. For not one man of the nation worked so hard as Odysseus worked and labored. Well, trouble was to be his portion, it seems, and mine to be sad on his account, never to be consoled, wondering how he can delay so long, and we don't know whether alive or dead. Surely they will all be mourning for him at home, the old man Laertes, and discreet Penelope, and Telemachus, whom he left a newborn babe in the house. Now the young man could not restrain himself. Tears dropped from his eyes to the ground as he heard his father's name, and he held up the purple robe before his eyes with both hands. Menelaus noticed this, and he considered whether he should leave him alone to think of his father, or if he should first ask him about everything. But while he was pondering things over in his mind, Helen appeared from her fragrant room upstairs, looking like Artemis of the golden arrows. Adriste came with her and moved up a handsome couch. Alcippe brought a rug of soft wool. Philo carried her silver basket. This was the gift of Alcandre, whose husband Polybus was a great nobleman in the Egyptian Thebes, with a palace full of treasures. He had given Menelaus 2 bathing tubs of silver, a couple of tripods, and 10 talents weight of gold. Besides this, his wife had given fine gifts to Helen, a golden distaff and a basket with wheels underneath made of silver, and the edges finished off in gold. This basket the attendant Philo brought and placed near her, stuffed with dressed yarn, and the distaff was laid across the top with dark blue wool upon it. Helen sat on the couch and put her feet on a footstool. She began at once, and asked her husband about everything in plain words. "Do we know, my dear, who these gentlemen are who have come to our house? Can I be wrong? Can it be true? I think it is. I declare I never saw any one so like, man or woman. It amazes me quite how this young man looks exactly like the son of Odysseus. I mean Telemachus, whom Odysseus left a newborn babe behind him when the whole nation invaded Troy, on my account, I am ashamed to say, and began that cruel war." Menelaus answered at once, "I think so too, my dear, now you mention the likeness. That man had feet just like that, and hands just like that, and the way his eyes go, and a head and hair on him just like that. Just a moment ago I was describing Odysseus, as I remembered him, what hard work he did for me, and all his distresses, when the young man burst into sobs and put up the purple cloak in front of his eyes." Then Prince Pisistratos said, "Your Majesty, that man's son, he is, in truth, as you say. But he is modest, and he feels shy on his first visit like this. He would not thrust himself forward or put in any remarks of his own in your presence, sir, when your speech delights us both as if it were a voice from heaven. And my royal father has sent me with him as his escort, for he desired to see you in case you might offer some advice or help. There are always troubles in a house when the father is away and the son is alone, and there are no others to stand up for him. So now, with Telemachus, his father is away, and there are no others in the town who will protect him from injustice." Menelaus answered, "Dear me, I did love that man, and here is his son in my house. Many a hard labor he wrought for me, and I made sure he would come here and let me show how I loved him beyond any man of the nation, if only we two had come speeding home over the sea in our ships, if Zeus Olympian, in his infinite wisdom, had granted that. Yes, I would have given him a city and house in Argos to live in, and brought him from Ithaca with his goods and his son and all his people. I would have cleared one of those cities which are all round here, part of my own domain. Yes, we should have always been in and out with each other, and nothing should ever have parted us or put an end to our happy friendship, until the black cloud of death should have swallowed us up. But I suppose that must have been too much happiness for God to grant, since he is the only one to whom return is denied." This made them all seek relief in tears. Argive Helen wept, Helen, the daughter of Zeus. Telemachus wept, and King Menelaus. Tears also were in the eyes of Nestor's son, for he thought of the admirable Antilochus, who was killed by the glorious son of Eos. But as he thought of him, he said plainly, "My lord king, my honored father would always say that you were courteous above all men. We've often talked of you at home together. So now, if it is possible at all, let me persuade you, for I do not enjoy crying over my supper. Besides, there will be tomorrow for that when daylight doth appear. Not that I grudge sorrowing for the dead when a mortal man meets his fate. Indeed, this is the only tribute we can pay to unhappy mankind, to cut the hair and to let the tears run over the cheeks. I know, because a brother of my own is dead, by no means the least valiant of our army. You must have known him. I never saw him myself, but they say that Antilochus was in the first rank, both as a sprinter and as a fighter." Menelaus answered, "My friend, you speak like a man of sense. You are older than your years. Your father is just the same. You get it from him. It is easy to know a man's breeding when Cronion spins out happiness for him in birth and marriage. Just as now we see he has been gracious to Nestor, always and all his days, so that he grows old in plenty and comfort, and his sons are men of sense and excellent spearmen. We will leave the lamentation which we had begun, and turn our thoughts to supper. Let them swill our hands. Stories may wait for tomorrow, when Telemachus and I will have something to say to each other." Then Asphalion poured water over their hands, and they helped themselves to the food which lay ready before them. But the admirable Helen had a happy thought. She lost no time, but put something into the wine they were drinking, a drug potent against pain and quarrels, and charged with forgetfulness of all trouble. Whoever drank this mingled in the bowl, not one tear would he let fall the whole day long. Not if mother and father should die, not if they should slay a brother or a dear son before his face, and he should see it with his own eyes. That was one of the wonderful drugs which the noble queen possessed, which was given her by Polydamna, the daughter of Thone, an Egyptian. For in that land the fruitful earth bears drugs in plenty, some good and some dangerous. And there every man is a physician and acquainted with such lore beyond all mankind, for they come of the stock of Paeon the healer. She dropped in the drug and sent round the wine, and then she said, "My lord King Menelaus, and you sons of honorable men who are here, but God gives good fortune or bad fortune to this man or that man when he pleases, for he can do all things. Sit there now in our hall. Eat and drink and enjoy yourself with talk, for I have something to tell in the same mood. I am not going to tell you everything, all the long tale, all the labors of Odysseus, that indomitable man. But one daring deed which he did in the land of Troy, where you Achaeans had so many hardships, He had allowed himself to be cruelly scored with lashes, and with a ragged old wrap over his shoulders, like a menial, he entered the streets of the enemy town. He pretended to be a beggar, when he was anything but that in the Achaean fleet. In this disguise, he entered the city of Troy, and they were all taken in. I was the only one who knew him in that shape, and I questioned him, but he was clever enough to evade me. However, I gave him a bath and a good rubbing with oil and swore a solemn oath never to let out the secret before he returned to the camp. And then he told me the whole plan of the Achaeans. He killed many a Trojan with his own spear before he got back again, and he brought away many secrets. There was loud lamentation among the women of Troy, but my own heart was glad, for I was already longing to come home again, and I mourned the infatuation which Aphrodite brought upon me when she carried me away from my native land and parted me from my daughter and my home and husband, although there was no fault in him, either of mind or body. When he heard this, Menelaus answered, "Upon my word, my dear, that is quite right and proper. I have heard tell of many heroes and their intelligence and their prudence, and I have traveled much in the world, but never did I set eyes on a man like Odysseus for patience and pluck. See now what the bold man did and dared in the Wooden Horse, where we were all hidden, the best men of the army, to bring death and ruin upon Troy. You came there, my dear, on that occasion. Some divine power must have sent you who wished to give triumph to the Trojans. And that fine fellow Deiphobus came with you. 3 times you walked all round our hiding place, feeling over it with your hands, and you called out the names of the best men in the army, mimicking the voice of each man's wife. I was there, and Diomedes and Odysseus sitting among the rest, and we listened to your calls. Both of us wanted to jump up and get out, or to answer at once from within. But Odysseus prevented us and kept us back, although we wanted to do it very much. So nobody uttered a sound. Only Anticlus would have made you some answer, but Odysseus held his 2 hands tight over the man's mouth and saved the whole nation. And there he held them firmly until Pallas Athena led you away. Then Telemachus said, quite to the point, "Your Majesty, that is only so much the worse. All this did not save him from a lamentable fate, nor would it, even if the heart within him had been made of iron. But let us go to our beds, that sleep may give us pleasure and peace for the time being." As he said this, Helen directed her maids to lay the beds under the open gallery, gay blankets of purple with coverlets upon them, and woolen gowns for them to put on. So the maids took torches out of the hall and laid the beds, and a marshal led out the guests. Telemachus and Nestor's son lay down to rest in the gallery before the hall door, but the king lay in a closet of the hall, and beside him the beautiful Helen in her long robe. When dawn showed her first gleams, Menelaus leapt out of his bed and put on his clothes and slung a sharp sword over his shoulder and put on his shoes and went out of his chamber. He sat down by Telemachus and said to him, "What business brought you here to Lacedaemon, brave Telemachus, over the broad back of the sea, public or private? Tell me, and conceal nothing." Telemachus answered him, "Your Majesty, I came to learn if you could tell me any news of my father. My house is being eaten up, my rich estate is ruined. The place is full of malicious men who kill my sheep forever, and my crumple horns skew the due cattle. They want my mother as a wife, but all they do is outrage and violence. And so I come to your knees as a suppliant, that you may tell me of that man's lamentable fate, whether you have seen it with your own eyes in any place, or heard from another the story of his wanderings. For he was born to sorrow, if any man ever was. Do not soften your words out of pity to spare me, but tell me plainly what you saw of him, I beseech you. If ever in word or deed my father, your faithful friend, made you a promise and did it before Troy, when you suffered all those hardships, remember that now for my sake, and tell me the truth." Menelaus, in hot anger, said to this, "Bless my soul, I declare they are a lot of cravens who wish to lie in the bed of a mighty man. Imagine a deer in the jungle which has laid her suckling fawns, just born, to sleep in the den of a strong lion while she goes over the hillocks and into the grassy dells to seek her food. Then the lion comes back to his lair and deals death on the lot of them, dams and fawns, and tears them to pieces. So Odysseus will deal death on these and tear them to pieces. Oh, Father Zeus, Athena, Apollo! Could he but appear before them as he was in the pleasant island of Lesbos, when he up and wrestled a match with Philomelides, and threw him by main force, and the whole nation was delighted. If he could be as he was then, and grapple with these men as they gaily go a-wooing, quick would be their death, more ruing than wooing. But as to your prayer and petition, I'll not misguide you along. I will not deceive you. But what the old man of the sea told me, and he speaks the truth, that I will tell you, and hide nothing. In Egypt, when I wished to return here, the gods kept me back because I had not performed the proper sacrifices to them. For the gods are always determined that we shall remember their claims. Well then, there is an island in the open sea before Egypt. They call it Pharos, as far off as a sea-going ship makes in a whole day when a whistling wind blows abaft. In this there is a capital harbor where voyagers take in fresh water before they push off again. There the gods kept me back for 20 days. Never a good wind blew over the brine, none of those which speed a ship over the broad back of the sea. All our provisions would have been used up, and the spirit of the men gone, if a divine being had not pitied me and saved me. A daughter of mighty Protheus, the old man of the sea, one Eidothea. I must have touched her heart when she met me, wandering alone without companions, for they used to go about fishing with hook and line, since famine tore at their bellies. She came up and spoke to me, and said, "Are you a fool, stranger, just slack and lazy, or do you prefer to let things slide, and do you enjoy hardships? Here you are all this long time, stuck in this island, and you cannot find any way out, while the heart of your men is fainting." I answered, "I tell you plainly, divine being, whoever you are, it is no wish of mine that I am stuck here, but I must have offended the deathless gods who rule the broad heavens. Do tell me, I pray, for the gods know all things. Which of the immortals chains me here? Which has tied me back from my way? Tell me how I shall make my journey over the fish-giving sea." That is what I said, and the divine being answered, "Well then, stranger, I will tell you exactly what to do. This place is frequented by the old man of the sea, immortal Proteus the Egyptian, a servant of Poseidon, who always tells the truth, who knows all the deep places of the sea. They say he is my father and begetter. If you could lie in wait for him and catch him, he would tell you your way and the measure of your homeward path, and how you may pass over the fish-giving sea. Yes, and he would tell you, sir, if you wish, what has been done at home, and both good and bad, while you were travelling on your long and painful road." I answered her, "Give me a plan yourself to catch the old man divine, or he may see me first, and forewarned is forearmed. The gods are kittle cattle for mortal men to tackle." Then she said, "Very well, stranger, I will tell you exactly what to do. When the sun mounts to mid-heaven, that is the time when the old man of the sea comes up out of the brine under the breath of the west wind, hidden by the dark ripples. And when he comes out, he likes to rest in a hollow cave. All round him sleep the seals in a shoal, the brood of Halosydne, breathing out the rank scent of the briny deep. You must choose 3 comrades with care, the best you have in your company. I will lead you to the place in the light of dawn and lay you all in a row. And now I will tell you all the old man's tricks. First he will inspect the seals and count them. When he has seen them and reckoned them up, he will lie down among them, like a shepherd among his sheep. As soon as you see him safe in his bed, that is the time for brawn and muscle. Catch him fast and hold him, however he may struggle and fight. He will turn into all sorts of shapes to try you, into all the creatures that live and move upon the earth, into water, into blazing fire. But you must hold him fast and press him all the harder. When he is himself and questions you in the same shape that he was when you saw him in his bed, then no more violence, but let the old man go. And then, sir, ask which god it is who is angry, and how you shall make your way homewards over the fish-giving sea. When she had spoken, she dived into the waves, but I went back to my ships on the sands, all in a brown study. When I reached the seaside, we prepared our meal, and holy night came on. Then we slept upon the seashore. But when dawn showed the first streaks of red, I walked along the shore of the sea, earnestly praying to the gods. And I took three comrades, men whom I trusted most for every enterprise. Meanwhile she had dived into the broad bosom of the sea and brought out four seal skins, newly flayed. It was a little dodge of her own she had made to take in her father. She had hollowed out beds in the sandy beach, and there she sat waiting. When we came near, she made us lie down in a row in these beds and threw a skin over each. Oh, that would have been a most trying wait for us, for we were terribly tormented by the horrible stink of the seals from the salt sea. Who would like to lie beside a monster of the salt sea? But she had thought of this without our asking, and made it all right. She had brought some ambrosia, and now she put a plug of it into each man's nose, smelling, oh, so sweet, which quite drowned out the stink of the monsters. All the morning we waited patiently. Then the seals came out of the sea in a body. They soon lay down in rows on the sand. And at noon the old man came out of the sea, and found his fat seals, and went his rounds, counting the number. Counted us first among the monsters, and never dreamt of the trick. Then he lay down himself in the count. At once we rushed on him with yells and seized him. The old man did not forget his arts. First he turned into a bearded lion, then into a serpent, then a leopard, then a great boar. He turned into running water and a tall tree in full leaf. But we held fast patiently. At last the old man grew tired of the tricks he knew so well, and questioned us in proper speech. Which of the gods devised this plan for you, Prince Atrides, and helped you to catch me like this against my will in your trap? What do you want? I answered, You know, sir, why do you ask and try to put me off? You know I am kept back in this island and cannot find a way out, so that my heart fails within me. I pray you to tell me, for the gods know all things, which of the immortals chains me here? Which has tied me back from my way? How I shall make my journey over the fish-giving sea? He answered me at once. Why, of course, you ought to have made a handsome sacrifice to Zeus and the other immortals before you embarked, if you wanted a quick passage to your native land over the Purple Sea. So it is not your lot to see your friends and return to your fine house and your native land until you go back to the waters of Aegyptus, that river which is fed from the sky, and perform a solemn sacrifice to the immortal gods who rule the broad heavens. Then, and not before, the gods will open the road which you desire. When I heard this, my heart was broken within me, that he commanded me to go a long and dangerous journey back to Egypt over the misty sea. Nevertheless, I said to him, This I will surely do, reverend sir, as you command me. Please, tell me, really and truly, did all our people come home safe in their ships, those who were left by Nestor and me when we set out from Troy? Did anyone perish by some unkind fate in his own ship, or with friends around him after we had wound up the war? He answered at once, My lord, why do you ask me that? You ought not to know or to learn my mind. You will not long be tearless when you hear all that happened. Many of them were lost, and many were left. But only two captains of the armed host perished, by the way, at the fighting you were present yourself. And one still lives, kept a prisoner somewhere in the broad sea. Aeas was lost with his galleys. First Poseidon wrecked him on the Gyrian rocks, but he was saved from the sea, and indeed he would have escaped death, although Athena was his enemy, if he had not uttered a boastful speech in his blindness. For he declared that he had escaped the devouring gulf, God willing or not. But Poseidon heard his wicked boast. Then and there he lifted the trident in his strong hand and struck the Gyrian rock and split him off. The rock remained where it was, but the splinter fell in the sea, the part on which Aeas was sitting at first when his heart was blinded, and this carried him with it into the bottomless deep. So there he perished with a mouthful of salt water. Your brother managed to escape the dangers of the sea. He was saved by Queen Hera, but when he was just coming to the steep cliff of Malea, a storm caught him and carried him over the sea in great distress to the headland of that country where Thyestes ruled long ago, and then ruled his son Aegisthus. Even then he found a safe voyage as the gods turned back the wind, and home they came. Full of joy, he set foot on his native soil and touched the ground and kissed it, while the tears ran down his cheeks at the welcome sight of his own country. But a watchman spied him from his lookout. Aegisthus, the traitor, had placed him there and promised him 2 nuggets of gold as a wage. The man had been watching for a year that the king might not land and pass unseen and be able to defend himself. He hastened with the news to the prince in his palace. At once Aegisthus arranged his plot. He chose the best fellows in the town, 20 of them, and posted them ready. At the other side of the house he ordered a feast to be prepared. Then he went down with murder in his heart, bringing chariot and horses to invite King Agamemnon, and so he brought him up, suspecting nothing, and feasted him, and killed him, as one might kill an ox at the manger. And not one of the king's escort was left, and not one of Aegisthus' men, but all were killed in the place. When he had finished, my heart was broken within me. I sat weeping and rolled my body on the sand and cared no longer to live and see the light of the sun. When I could weep no more, the truthful old man of the sea said to me, "My lord, do not go on weeping so long, since there is no help for it. But lose no time in trying to make your way back to your native land. Either you will find him alive, or Orestes will have caught him and killed him, and then you will come in for the funeral feast." This gave me heart and courage and comforted me in spite of my grief. So I said to him, "So much then for these. But there is a third I would ask you to name, who is still held prisoner somewhere in the broad sea, or he may be dead. But I want to hear, though it may hurt me." At once he answered, "Odysseus Laertiades, the man of Ithaca. I saw him in an island, weeping hot tears, in the house of Calypso the nymph, who holds him by force, and he cannot get away to his native land, since he has neither men nor galleys to take him over the broad back of the sea. But your fate, royal Menelaus, is not to die and meet your end in Argos. The immortals will convey you to the Elysian plain at the end of the earth, where golden-headed Rhadamanthus dwells. That is the place where life is easiest for mankind. No snow, no stormy wind or rain, but Zephyrus with his gentle whistling breeze ever comes up from the ocean to refresh mankind. For you are Helen's husband, and they look on you as one of the family of Zeus." With these words he dived into the billowy deep. Then I returned to the ships, all in a brown study, with my loyal comrades. When we reached our ships, we made our meal, and as soon as sacred night came on, we laid us to rest on the seashore. But when dawn came again, rosy through the mist, first of all we launched the ships, then we set up masts and sails, then the men embarked and took their seats on the benches and paddled away over the sea. Back we went to Egyptus, that river which is fed from the sky, and there I stayed the ships and performed the solemn sacrifice. When I had thus allayed the resentment of the everlasting gods, I built a barrow for Agamemnon, that his name might not be forgotten. This done, I set out, and the immortals gave me a fair wind, and brought me very soon to my native land. So, come, now stay here in my mansion for 10 or 12 days, and then I will give you a good send-off and a handsome gift, 3 horses and a chariot. I will give you a fine chalice, too, that when you pour your drops to the immortal gods, you may think of me all your days. But Telemachus knew better, and said, My lord, do not keep me here long. It is true, I could stay here a whole year with you, idle, and I should not miss home or parents, for I am terribly in love with your stories and your conversation. But my companions are bored already in Pylos, and I am staying here a long time. If you should offer me a gift, let it be something for me to treasure. But horses I will not take to Ithaca. I will leave them for you to enjoy, for you are lord of a broad plain, in which is plenty of clover. Here is galingale and wheat and spelt and broad-eared white barley. But in Ithaca we have neither wide roads nor meadows. It is a goat country, much pleasanter than a horse country. None of the islands in the sea is good for driving or good for meadows, and Ithaca least of all. When he said this, the great champion smiled and stroked him with one hand and said to him, You come of good blood, my boy, to hear you speak. Then I will give you something else that will be easy enough. You shall have the best and most precious of the treasures which lie in my house. I will give you a mixing bowl finely wrought. It is all silver, but the lips are finished off with gold. It is a genuine work of Hephaestus. The noble Phidamas presented it to me. He is king of Sidon, and his house gave me shelter on my homeward journey. Now it shall be yours. As they were thus conversing, the banqueters arrived at the king's mansion. They drove sheep with them, and carried wine that makes glad the heart of men, and their wives at home were sending on the bread. While these were busy about the feast in Lacedaemon, the others in front of the house of Odysseus were enjoying their game of quoits and javelins upon the paved space, as usual, full of riotousness. Antinous was sitting there, and the handsome Eurymachus, the 2 leaders among them, who excelled in all their feats. Just then the young man Noemon appeared and asked a question of Antinous. "Do we know, or don't we, Antinous, when Telemachus is coming back from Pylos? He took my boat with him, and I want to cross over to the lowlands of Elis, where I have 12 mares, with as many hardy mules at foot unbroken. I want to drive off one of them to be broken in." These words struck amazement into their hearts, for they did not think he had gone to Pylos. They supposed he was somewhere about the farms with the sheep or with the swineherd. Antinous answered, "Tell me the truth about it. When did he go? What lads went with him? The pick of Ithaca? Or his own serfs and servants? He might do that, of course. Tell me, I want to know the truth. Did he steal your boat against your will, or did he beg and pray until you consented?" Noemon said, "I consented, all right. What could anyone else have done when a man like him has something in his mind and asks a favor? It is hard to say no to a borrower. The best lads in town went with him, and I noticed their leader going aboard. Mentor it was, if he wasn't a god, but he was the very spirit of Mentor. What does surprise me is that I saw the very man himself here yesterday morning, but by that time he was on board ship on his way to Pylos." He said his say, and off he went to his father's house, and the 2 were left behind, thunderstruck. They made the others stop playing and sit down together. Then Antinous spoke to them in high displeasure, while the dark places of his heart were full of rage, and his eyes flashed fire. "Damn it all! This is a monstrous piece of defiance, this journey of Telemachus. We never expected him to manage it. Off he goes with all this crowd against him. A young boy like that launches a ship, picks and chooses the best of the whole town. First corps to him, and more trouble to follow. but I pray Zeus may destroy his power first. Come along, get me a fast boat and 20 men, that I may lie for him on his way back and watch in the strait between Ithaca and the cliffs of Samos. Then he shall finish his filial expedition in anything but ship-shape fashion. They all applauded and told him to go ahead. Then they got up and repaired to the dining hall. But Penelopeia did not remain long unacquainted with what they said and what they were scheming in the depths of their hearts. For Medon the marshal told her. He overheard them from outside the courtyard while they were weaving their scheme inside. He went into the house to inform her, and as he stepped over her threshold, Penelopeia said to him, "Marshal, why have these people sent you out? To order the servants of my noble husband to drop their work and get dinner ready for them? If only they might woo no more and visit no more in this world. If only this dinner here this day might be their latest and their last. Here you come constantly in crowds, and you have wasted a heap of wealth, the possessions of Telemachus, my clever boy. Did you never hear from your own fathers, when you were children long ago, how Odysseus behaved towards them? Never one unjust thing did he say or do among his people, like the common run of princes who hate one and favor another. That man never did a cruel thing in his life. But your way of thinking is as clear as your ugly doings. There is no gratitude in the world for good deeds done." But Medon answered respectfully, "I only wish, my lady, that this were the worst. But there is something still worse and still more dangerous which they are plotting, and I pray that Cronion may not bring it to pass. They want to murder him with cold steel on his way home. He has gone to Pylos and sunny Lacedaemon to inquire news of his father." When she heard this, her knees gave way and her heart fainted, and for a long time she could not utter a word. Her eyes filled with tears, and her soft voice was choked. But at last she found words and was able to say, "Marshal, why is my son gone? He need not have anything to do with seafaring ships which carry men over the wide waters as horses over the wide world. Did he wish to leave not even his name in the wide world?" Medon answered as before, "I do not know whether some god sent him or if it was his own notion to go to Pylos. But he did go to get news of his father, whether he is on his way home or what fate has befallen him." This said, he went back through the house. But she was plunged in heart-burning grief. She could not bring herself to sit upon a chair, and there were plenty in the room, but she sat upon the floor near the doorway, bitterly lamenting, while the maids all whimpered, young and old, all through the house. Amid her sobs, Penelopeia said to them, "Listen, my dears, the Olympian has allotted to me sorrows above all women who were bred and born with me. Long ago I lost a good husband, a man with a lion's heart, first in the whole nation for every noble gift. Now, again, my beloved son has been torn away by the tempests without a word from our house, and I never heard of his going. Hard women you are. Not even you, not one of you, could find it in her heart to awake me from my bed, though you knew quite well when he went away to his vessel. If I had only heard that he was planning this voyage, I declare he should never have gone, however much he wanted to go, or he should have gone over my dead body. Go, someone, hurry up, and call old Dolius, the man my father gave me when I came here, the man who keeps the garden with all those trees. Tell him to go quickly and find Laertes, and tell him the whole story. Perhaps he can think of some plan. He may come out and complain to the people how these men wish to wipe out his whole race and the family of the noble Odysseus." Then Eurycleia, the nurse, said in answer, "Dear lass, kill me with cruel steel, and let me be in the house, but I will hide naught from thee. I knowed the whole thing. I gave all it told me, bread and meal of the best, but it made me swear a good oath not to breathe one word to thee till 12 days pass, or thou'st ask thy sen about his going away. He was afeard they might spoil thy pretty skin wi' weeping. Come now, take a bath, put on clean linen, go up to thy chamber wi' the maids, and pray to Athenia, the daughter of Zeus Almighty. Maybe she's hold him safe even from death. And don't you worry, the poor old man, who has worrits enough. I make sure the Lord God do not hate the kin of Arsacides, but there will be some and yet left of the world to own the tall house and all the fat farms out yonder." With these words the old woman calmed the grief of her mistress and wiped away her tears. Then the lady bathed and put on clean linen and went up to her chamber with the maids. She filled a basket with the sacred barley groats and prayed to Athena. "Hear me, daughter of Zeus Almighty, Atritone, if ever my undaunted Odysseus burnt for thee the fat thigh slices in this house, remember that for me now, and keep my dear son safe, and defend me against these proud and riotous men." Then she cried aloud the women's Alleluia, and the goddess heard her prayer. But the pretenders applauded in the gloomy hall when they heard her cry, and you might hear one say to another of these violent men, "Sure enough, after all our courting, my lady is going to marry again, and she does not know that death is ready for her son." That is what they would say, for they did not know what the cry meant. But Antinous warned them and said, "Now then, you fellows, no bragging. Not a word of any sort must pass your lips, if you please. Someone may tell tales inside. Come along, just let us get up quietly and carry out the plan we thought so good." Then he chose out 20, the best fellows there, and they set out for the ship on the seashore. The ship, first of all, was launched into deep water, the mast and sail set up in the dark hull, the oars hung to the thole pins by their leathern loops, arms and armor were all brought by eager attendants. Well out in the water they anchored her and left her there, while they ate their meal on shore and waited for evening to come. But there in the upper chamber lay true-hearted Penelopea, without food, touching neither meat nor drink, wondering whether her innocent son would escape death, or whether he would be brought low by the men of violence. Even as a lion is balked and helpless with fear when they put a circle of hunters round him, so she lay troubled in mind until she fell into a deep sleep. Then she sank down and slept, and her weary frame had rest. Now Athena Brighteyes had a thought. She made a phantom in the shape of a woman, Iphthyme, another daughter of Icarius, and the wife of Eumelus, who lived in Pherae. She sent it to the house of Odysseus that Penelopea might have peace from her tears and lamentable grief. It came into the room along the keyhole strap and spoke to her, leaning over her head. "Are you asleep, Penelopea? With your heart full of sorrow? Nay, the gods who live in quiet and peace will not have you weep and mourn, since your boy will yet return, for he has not offended the gods in any way." Penelopea answered as she slumbered sweetly within the gates of dreams, "What brings you here, sister? You never paid me a visit before, living all that way off. Now you tell me to cease from my mourning and all the pains which trouble me in heart and mind. Long ago I lost a good husband, a man with a lion's heart, first in the whole nation for every noble gift. And now again my beloved son has gone on board ship, a mere child who knows nothing of plots or parliaments. I am really more grieved for my boy than for the other. For him, I am all of a tremble, and I fear what may happen to him in the place where he is gone, or on the sea. For enemies, many, are planning and plotting against him, determined to kill him before he can return to his native land." Then the dim phantom answered, "Take courage. Let not your heart fear too much, for one is near to guide him whom others have often prayed to stand by their side. Pallas Athenia, and she pities you in your grief. She it is who has sent me now to tell you this." Penelopea the true-hearted answered, "If you are really divine, and a god sent you here, tell me also about that unhappy man. Is he still alive anywhere? Does he see the light of the sun? Or is he already dead and within the house of Hades?" Then the dim phantom answered and said, I may not tell you for certain whether he is alive or dead. It is a bad thing to babble like the blowing wind. As she said this, she slipped along the bolt of the door into the outer air. Penelope leapt up, and her heart warmed within her that this phantom had appeared so clearly in the dark night. But the plotters embarked and sailed over the waters with foul murder in their hearts for Telemachus. There is a rocky islet between Ithaca and the cliffs of Samos, quite a small one, called Asteris, and harbors in it for ships on both sides. There they lay in wait for him. Book 5. Hermes is sent to Calypso's island. Odysseus makes a raft and is carried to the coast of Scheria. Dawn rose from her bed beside old Tithonus, bringing light for mortals and immortals both, and the gods came to their morning session. There in his place was Zeus Almighty Thunderer in the heights, and Athena made them a speech about Odysseus and his troubles, for she was concerned that he still remained in captivity. Father Zeus and all you gods everlasting and blessed, from this time forth let no sceptred king be kind and gentle. Let none have justice in his heart. Let him always be harsh and act the tyrant. For none of his subjects remembers that noble prince Odysseus who ruled them like a kind father. Now he lies, wretched and miserable, Calypso's prisoner in her island, and he cannot return to his native land, for he has no men and no galleys to carry him over the broad back of the sea. And now again they want to murder his beloved son, who has gone to Pylos and to Lacedaemon to find out news of his father. They are only waiting for his return. Zeus, cloud-gatherer, answered, My dear child, what in heaven do you mean by that? Was not the whole thing your own notion? Didn't you want him to come home that way and take his vengeance? As for Telemachus, you can easily manage to bring him back safe and sound and let the plotters just sail home again. Then he called to his son Hermes and said, Hermes, you are my messenger, and here is an errand for you. Go and declare to Calypso our unchangeable will that Odysseus shall return after all his troubles. But no god shall go with him and no mortal man. He shall build a raft, and a hard voyage he shall have, until after 20 days he shall come to land on Scheria, the rich domain of our own kinsmen, the Phaeacians. They shall honor him like a god in the kindness of their hearts, and they shall escort him in one of their ships to his native land. They shall give him plenty of gold and bronze and heaps of fine clothing, more indeed than he could have brought from Troy as his share of the spoils if he had come home without mishap. For this is how he is destined to return to his tall house and his native land and to see his friends once more. The king's messenger was ready, as he had been when he brought death to the watcher Argos. He put on his fine shoes, those golden, incorruptible shoes which used to carry him over moist and dry to the ends of the earth, swift as the breath of the winds. He took up the staff which lays a spell on men's eyes, if he wills, or wakens the sleeping. Holding this, Argiphontes flew away swift and strong. One step on Pieria, and he swooped from the upper air upon the deep. Then he skimmed the waves like a seagull which hunts fish in the dangerous inlets of the barren sea, and dives into the brine with folded wings. Such was the shape of Hermes as he rode on the rippling waves. When at last he came to that far-off island, he left the blue sea and passed over the land until he reached the great cave where Calypso lived. He found her in the cave, with her beautiful hair flowing over her shoulders. A great fire blazed on the hearth, and the burning logs of cedar and juniper wafted their fragrant scent far over the island. Calypso sat within by her loom, singing in a lovely voice and shooting her golden shuttle to and fro. A thick coppice of trees grew round the cave, alder and aspen and sweet-smelling cypress. There the birds would sail to rest on their outspread wings, owls and falcons, and long-tongued sea-ravens who busy themselves about the waters. Over the gaping mouth of the cave trailed a luxuriant grapevine with clusters of ripe fruit, and 4 rills of clear water ran in a row close together, winding over the ground. Beyond were soft meadows thick with violets and wild celery. That was a sight to gladden the very gods. King's messenger Argifontes stood still and gazed about him with deep content. Then he went into the cave, and Calypso knew him as soon as she saw him, for all those of the divine race know one another when they meet, even if they live a long way off. But Odysseus was not there. He was sitting in his usual place on the shore, wearing out his soul with lamentation and tears. Calypso gave him greeting. "My dear Hermes, this is an honor. With your golden rod and all, what has brought you here? You do not often pay me a visit, but you are heartily welcome. Tell me what you want. I am glad to do it, if I can, and if it is doable. But do come in and let me entertain my guest." With these words, she led him to a seat that shone with diligent polishing, and set a table beside him with a dish of ambrosia and a cup of red nectar. The royal messenger ate, he drank, he enjoyed a hearty meal, and then he answered her question. "You ask me what brings me here as one god to another. Very well, I will tell you the whole history as you ask. Zeus sent me here. I did not want to come here. Who would want to travel all that distance over the salt water? No end to it, and no city of mortals anywhere near to provide a god with sacrifice and a handsome feast. But no god can shirk or baffle the will of Zeus Almighty. That is quite impossible. He says there is a man here, one of those who were 9 years fighting before Priam's town, and the most unlucky of them all. It took them 10 years to capture that city. Then they set out for home, but on the way they offended Athena, and she raised a bad wind and a heavy sea against them. All his good comrades were drowned, but he, as it seems, was carried here by winds and waters. That's the man, and the orders are to send him away at once, for it is not his fate to perish in this place far from his friends. It is decreed that he shall see his friends again and return to his tall house and his native land." Calypso shivered, and she spoke her mind plainly. "A hard-hearted lot you are, you gods, and as jealous can be. Why are you shocked if a goddess sleeps with a man and makes no secret of it, when she happens to find one she could love as a husband? It is always the same. When blushing dawn shows Orion, all you gods were shocked. You live as you like yourselves, but you would not rest until Artemis let fly one of her gentle bolts and killed him in Ortygia. Her holiness on that golden throne. Then Demeter had a fancy for Iasion and pleased herself, made her love-bed on the furrows of the ploughland. Zeus heard of it in no time and killed him dead with a fiery thunderbolt. So you gods are all shocked at me now, because there's a mortal man with me. I saved the man when he was straddling across a ship's keel all by himself, after Zeus had sent another fiery thunderbolt at him and smashed the ship to pieces in the middle of the sea. All his crew were drowned, and the winds carried him here. I loved him and cherished him, and I did think I would make him immortal like myself. But since it is impossible for any god to shirk or baffle the will of Zeus Almighty, let him go to the devil over the barren sea, if that is the command of his mightiness. I will not give him a passage home. I have no ships and no sailors to carry him over the broad back of the sea. But I will gladly advise him and help him to get home." Hermes answered, "All right, let him go now. And don't forget the wrath of God, or he may be angry with you one fine day." So Argifontes departed, having delivered his message, and Calypso went in search of Odysseus. She found him sitting upon the shore. The tears were never dry in his eyes. Life, with its sweetness, was slowly trickling away. He cared for her no longer. At night he was forced to sleep by her side in the cave, although the love was all on her part, and he spent the days sitting upon the rocks or the sands, staring at the barren sea and sorrowing. Calypso came up to him and said, "Poor old fellow, please don't sit here lamenting any more. Don't let yourself pine away like this. I'm going to send you off at once, and glad to do it. Come along. Cut down trees, hew them into shape, make a good broad raft. You can lay planks across it, and it shall carry you over the misty sea. I will provide you with bread, water, red wine, as much as you like. You need not starve. I'll give you plenty of clothes and send a fair wind behind you to bring you home safe and sound. If it so please the gods who rule the broad heavens, who are stronger than I am both to will and to do. As she said this, the ever-patient man shivered, and he said plainly, I'm sure there is something else in your mind, goddess, and no kind send-off for me when you tell me to cross the great gulf of the sea on a raft. That is a difficult and dangerous thing even for well-built ships, although they sail swiftly enough when they are blessed with a good wind from heaven. And I should not care to embark on a raft without your goodwill, not unless you could bring yourself to swear a solemn oath that you will not work some secret mischief against me. The beautiful goddess smiled and stroked him with her hand, saying, Ah, you are a wicked man, always wide awake, or you would never have thought of such a thing. Now then, I swear by heaven above and by earth beneath and the pouring force of Styx, that is the most awful oath of the blessed gods, I will work no secret mischief against you. No, I mean what I say. I will be as careful for you as I should be for myself in the same need. I know what is fair and right. My heart is not made of iron, and I am really sorry for you. Then she led him briskly to the great cave. They went in together, the goddess and the man. He took the seat which Hermes had just left. She laid the table with food and drink, everything which mortal man can eat, and sat opposite while the maids brought her nectar and ambrosia. They took what they wanted, and when they had had a good meal, the beautiful Calypso spoke first. Prince Odysseus Laertiades, now is the time to show your famous cleverness. So, you want to go home at once? Well, I wish you luck all the same. If you knew what troubles you will have before you get to Ithaca, you would stay where you are and keep this house with me and be immortal, however much you might want to see your wife, whom you long for day in and day out. Is she prettier than me? I think not. I don't think it likely that a mortal woman would set herself up as a model of beauty against a goddess. Odysseus knew what to say to that, and he answered at once, Gracious goddess, don't be cross with me. I know all that as well as you do. My wife is nothing compared to you for beauty. I can see that for myself. She is mortal. You are immortal and never grow old. But even so, I long for the day of my homecoming. And if some god wrecks me again on the deep, I will endure it, for I have a patient mind. I have suffered already many troubles and hardships in battle and tempest. This will only be one more. As he spoke, the sun went down and the darkness came, and these two lay down in the corner of the lofty cave and enjoyed their love together. When dawn showed her rosy fingers through the mists, Odysseus put on tunic and cloak, and the nymph a silvery wrap with a golden girdle under it round the hips and a veil over her head. Then she began to help Odysseus in his work. She gave him a good handy axe of bronze, double-edged, with a well-fitted handle of olive wood, and an adze with a smooth shaft, and led him to the end of the island. There was a coppice of tall trees, long since, dry and sapless and easy to float, alder and aspen and pine trees, high as the sky. When she had shown him the trees, Calypso went back, and he began to fell them. He worked fast, and soon cut down 20 trees, then trimmed them with the axe, shaped them neatly, and made them true to the line. Then Calypso brought him a boring tool, and he bored holes and fitted the spars together, making them fast with pegs and joints. He made his craft as wide as a skillful shipwright would plan out the hull of a bluff ketch. He fixed ribs along the sides and decking planks above, and finished off with copings along the ribs. He set a mast in her and fitted a yard upon it, and he made also a steering oar to keep her straight. All round he ran bulwarks of wattle to keep the water out, and threw brushwood into the bottom. Then Calypso brought him cloth to use for a sail, and he made that too. Stays and halyards and sheets he made fast in their places, and dragged her down to the shore on rollers. In 4 days he had finished the whole, and on the fifth Calypso saw him off after she had bathed him and clothed him in garments scented with juniper. She did not forget a skin of red wine and another large one full of water, with provisions in a bag, tasty stuff and plenty of it. And she sent with him a fair wind, friendly and soft. Odysseus was glad of that wind as he set his sail, and sat by the stern oar steering like a seaman. No sleep fell on his eyes, but he watched the Pleiades and the late-settling wagoner, and the bear, or the wagon, as some call it, which wheels round and round where it is, watching Orion, and alone of them all never takes a bath in the ocean. Calypso had warned him to keep the bear on his left hand as he sailed over the sea. 17 days he sailed over the sea, and on the 18th day he approached the nearest point of the Phaeacian country, with its shady uplands. The island looked like a great shield lying upon the misty deep. But the Earthshaker was now on his way back from the Ethiopians, and caught sight of him in the distance, from the Solomon Hills. He fell into a royal rage and shook his head as he cried out, "Damn it all! The gods have changed their minds about Odysseus as soon as I was out of the way. And there he is, close to Phaeacia, where he is fated to find the end of the tribulations which afflict him. But I promise that I will yet give him a good run of bad luck." Then he gathered the clouds and stirred up the deep with his trident. He roused all the tempestuous winds and covered in clouds both land and sea. Night rushed down from the heavens. East wind and south wind dashed together, west wind blowing hard and north wind from the cold heights, rolling up great billows. Odysseus felt his knees tremble and his heart fail, and in despair he spoke to his own strong spirit. "How unlucky I am! What will be the end of all this? I fear what the goddess said was true. She said I was to have trouble in full measure before I could see my native land, and here it is, all coming true. What clouds are these that Zeus has brought up over the broad heavens? How he has stirred up the deep! How all the winds come sweeping upon me! Now my destruction's a safe thing. Thrice blessed were my countrymen, 4 times blessed indeed, who perished on the field before Troy to please the royal house of Atreus. I wish I had died there and found my fate on that day when a host of enemies were casting their sharp spears at me over the dead body of Achilles. Then I should have had burial, and my countrymen would have spread my fame. Now I am doomed to die an ignominious death." As he said this, a great wave rolled up, towering above him, and drove his vessel around. He lost hold of the steering oar and fell out into the water. The mast snapped in the middle as the fearful tempest of warring winds fell upon it. Sail and yard were thrown from the wreck. He was kept long under water, and he could not get clear, for his clothes weighed him down. But at last he came up, spitting the bitter brine out of his mouth, while it ran down streaming off his head. For all this he did not forget his raft, exhausted as he was, but he made a dash after it through the seas, and caught hold, and sat in the middle to save his life if he could. Round and round it went on the waves. As the north wind in autumn rolls up lumps of thistles and carries them over the fields, so that winds blew the raft round and round over the water. Now the south wind tossed it to the north wind, now the east wind passed it to the west wind in turn. But Ino saw him. She was a daughter of Cadmus, and a beautiful creature, once a mortal who spoke with human voice. Now she is Leucothea, the white sea goddess, to whom the gods have given that honor in the salt deeps. She pitied Odysseus, as he was buffeted about in this miserable way. Like a great shearwater, she rose on the wing from the waves, and perching on the wreck, she said, "Poor Odysseus, you're odd, I see, true to your name. Why does Poseidon Earthshaker knock you about in this monstrous way and persecute you so much? But he will never destroy you, although that is what he wants to do. Well, this is my advice, and I think you have sense enough to take it. Strip off your clothes and let the raft go roaming. Take to the sea and swim, and you may get your grip on Phaeacian land, since it is ordained that you shall find safety there. Here, take this veil and stretch it under your chest. It is a divine thing, and while you have it, there is no fear that you will drown or come to any harm. When you have your hands fast on the land, take it off and throw it back into the sea as far as you can, but turn your face away as you do it. Then the goddess gave him the veil and dived back herself into the sea, like a great shearwater, and the dark waves covered her. But Odysseus was left in doubt how much he had endured patiently already, and he was angry as he said to himself, "More trouble for me. I can't help thinking that some god or other is weaving another snare when she tells me to leave the raft. At all events, I won't do it yet. She said I should get ashore there, but the land was a long way off when I caught sight of it. Well, I know what I'll do. This seems the best thing. As long as these sticks hold together, I'll stick to them and make the best of my hard luck. But if the sea smashes them up, I'll swim for it, since I cannot see anything better to do." While these thoughts were passing through his mind, Poseidon Earthshaker brought up another great wave, a terrible great mass that curved over him and drove him along. Planks and spars were scattered as a strong wind catches a heap of dry straw and scatters it over the ground. Odysseus straddled across one spar as if he were riding a horse and stripped off his clothes, all he had left of the gifts of kind Calypso. He fastened the veil under his chest and fell flat on the water, with arms spread abroad to swim. The mighty Earthshaker saw him and nodded his head as he said to himself, "That's right. You have had a good lot of troubles already, and now you may go tossing about on the water and get ashore if you can. Even if you get there, I don't think you will be able to complain of having less than your share of trouble." With these words he whipped up his horses, they shook their manes, and carried him to Ægae, where his famous palace was. Now it was the turn of Athena, the daughter of Zeus, and this was her plan. She tied up the courses of all the other winds, and commanded them to rest and be quiet. But she sent a steady wind from the north and broke down the waves in front of Odysseus that he might make his way to Phaeacia and save himself alive. After that he tossed about for 2 nights and 2 days on the rolling waves, always looking for death. But the third day broke with rosy streaks of dawn, and when the light was full the wind fell, and there came a breathless calm. Odysseus lifted high on a great swell, took a quick look forward, and there close by he saw the land. As a father's life is welcome to his children, when he has been lying tormented by some fell disease, and in his agony long drawn out, the hateful hand of death has touched him, but God has given relief from his troubles, no less welcome to Odysseus was the sight of earth and trees, and he swam on longing to feel his feet on solid ground. When he came near enough for a man's voice to carry, he could hear the dull sound of the sea breaking upon the rocks. The great waves were crashing against a rough coast and belching up terrific showers of spray which covered the cliffs in a mist. But there was no harbor for a ship and no roadstead, nothing but bluffs and crags and headlands along that shore. Then Odysseus felt his limbs grow weak, and his heart failed within him. Dauntless though he was disturbed, and said to himself, "My trouble is not over yet. Zeus has granted me to see the land which I never hoped to see. Now I have come to the end of my journey over all that immeasurable gulf, but there is no way to get out of the water. Sharp reefs outside, roaring surges all round, a smooth cliff running up straight with deep water along the shore, nowhere to stand on my 2 feet and find safety. If I try to get out, I suppose the swell will catch me and dash me on the sharp teeth of some rock. Then much good will it do me to try. If I swim along the coast on the chance of finding a bay and a sloping beach, I am afraid the gale may catch me again and carry me out into the deep sea, and that will be a bad job. Or luck may send me a monster out of the sea. Amphitrite is famous for monsters. I know the Earthshaker has an odd dislike for Odysseus." As these thoughts passed through his mind, the swell carried him against the rocky shore. Then his skin would have been torn off and all his bones broken if Athena had not put a thought into his mind. He flung himself upon a rock and caught hold with both hands and clung there groaning until the wave had passed on. That time he saved himself, but the backwash rolled upon him again and carried him far out into the sea. When you drag a squid out of its hole, you may see a lot of little stones sticking to the suckers. That is what his strong hands looked like, with rags of skin and flesh and bits of rock along the fingers when the waves swallowed him up. And then Odysseus would have perished, fate or no fate, if Athena had not put prudence into his mind. He got clear of the line of breakers foaming along the shore, and swam along outside, keeping his eye on the land in case he should see a bay and a sloping beach. On he swam, until he came opposite the mouth of a river, and glad he was to see it. That seemed a good place, as there were no rough stones, and it gave some shelter from the wind. He saw the river pouring into the sea, and prayed to the river god in his heart. "Hear me, Lord, whoever thou art, how